See you, man.
No, it's really nice to
you
see you.
You were
again.
Traveling? You were in.
Yeah, my mom was visiting Taiwan and she just went back to the US. And during her trip to Taiwan, I decided to take her to Korea for a few days because she really wants to go. And while I was in Korea, guess what happened over there?
Was it the martial law?
Oh, I wasn't there for the martial law, but that happened right before I went. But once I was there, there were all these demonstrations against the president outside of the National Assembly.
Before the
and
after.
I was,
oh,
no,
you mean for the
after
impeachment,
the martial law.
like kind of pushing for impeachment and all that?
Yeah, they were pushing for it because the opposition party, like the threshold for impeachment needs to be 2/3 of the National Assembly. There's 300 seats and the opposition party has like 190 something. So they needed some people within the, I don't know if it's 190 something, but it was like, they needed some people within the president's own party
Right,
to also
right.
support the impeachment for it to work. So they were outside. And at that point, the people in the incumbent party were boycotting the election or abstaining from it. So then people were like demonstrating, pressuring them to vote for the impeachment. So yeah, that was, I was at the Hyundai department store, which is just a few blocks away from the National Assembly. And I got a little notification on my phone, like saying there's this going on over here. So be careful around there. So I'm like, okay,
damn.
I'm going to go check it
all
out.
Right.
So
you saw the drama.
I saw parts of it. I don't really understand how Korean politics works on the ground, but the way it was organized, it was really, really unusual to me. It was like a huge like music festival almost.
I heard there's some drama in Taiwan right now in the legislature.
Oh yeah,
they're like changing some procedural rule or something, and the U.S. is talking about how the KMT TPP are going rogue.
Well, this is the thing. Like in the past few years, the DPP's been abusing the process of impeachment. So what happens is they won't do a good election. They'll lose the election, and then they'll try to impeach the KMT candidate or whatever once they get into office. So the KMT is trying to increase the requirements for doing an impeachment. And
doesn't that actually go against them at the moment,
given
who's the president and who's in control of the legislature?
That's very true, but it also goes to show how the DPP's long-term plans are not really to do better elections.
In my opinion, that's a sure sign of corruption.
Part of it is also,
because you're protecting very, very short-term interests. Yeah.
Exactly. Because you look at, like, say what you will of, say, the Communist Party of China, they plan things in, like, what, like 5 years, 10 years, 50 years at a time, whereas over here, it's just, like, you look at Lai Ching-te, the current leader, and all he really seems to be concerned about is his re-election in 3 years. So it is a sad state. Part of the things that the KMT is pushing for in that bill is the how if you want to get enough, if you're doing a petition to impeach somebody, the people who sign it need to present their IDs, which they say it's to prevent fraud in the process, which kind of makes sense. But then the DPP is like, well, isn't this a scammer's dream come true, because they get access to everybody's ID numbers? And I'm like, well, think about in everyday life, all the places where you need to give your ID numbers, like when you go to the hospital or when you're signing up for applying for a phone number. It's like, there's going to be identity leaks and all that stuff regardless. Why are you fixated on this instance?
Something's
of
going on, man, because it's this that
right.
mirrors everything that's going on in the U.S. too. Every party impeaches the, like, Biden got impeached, Trump got impeached. Trump is probably going to get impeached again this time. It's gotten to the point where it's meaningless.
Trump's been impeached.
Right? So these impeachments are symbolic here in the U.S. anyway. Like, you don't get removed from office. It's just a strike against you, you know, whatever. It's like you get in the headlines and you get to talk shit about the other guy and waste everyone's time. But I don't know, man. I don't know what's going on, but this is a, like, this is, there is a, there's like a general failure going on of like liberal democracy around the world. And it's all the same pattern. Governments get elected. I don't know how they get elected, because like Starmer, like these guys get elected and the second they take office, their approval rating drops like 7 points. they didn't even do anything.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I don't know what's going on, but there isn't a single goddamn leader in the West that has any real staying power right now, except honestly for Trump. There's no one. No one has made a comeback like Trump, right? I was happy.
What do you think about that?
I was happy. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Democrats really deserve to get their asses handed to them, given the way they've basically gaslit the entire U.S. population.
So I don't know, man. I just think I'm not a Trumpist. Here's the thing is like, I don't, I will say like broadly, I think Trump's, plan, here's the thing that pisses me off about liberals is like Trump's plan actually has a coherent, it seems to have a coherent theory behind it. Right. There are, I think he's looking at the system of, I don't know what to call it, but it is an imperial system. It's primarily a financial and military system. And he's saying it's not good for Americans. It's like I think he's like I think a lot of the popularity behind Trump had to do with the recognition of the ways, I don't know if the voters necessarily connected the dots per se, but I've never seen an election like this where foreign policy was so deeply connected in the minds of voters to the domestic immiseration. And it was a very simple connection. Why are you sending $130 billion or whatever it is? It's an imaginary number. You just write it on the fucking chalkboard. Why are you sending $130 billion and then authorizing another $30 billion and then authorizing another what? And then this hurricane comes through and absolutely demolishes North Carolina, and people get max $750. You know what I mean?
It's insulting.
And people are so fucking fed up with it. And this is why I think there is this sort of almost like inchoate anger, but it's actually pointed upwards, and you get these people. I'm shocked at, like, I am personally shocked at how much popular support there is for Mangione. For Luigi, it's meaningful. Yeah. I thought this is a stupid story or whatever, but the outbreak of like public sympathy for this guy. Yeah,
I was surprised by that, to be honest.
But the thing that really surprised me was how
because it's normies. I mean, like just 5 years ago, the people celebrating it would be like these fringe elements in society, but now it's like a bunch of normies that are celebrating.
Yeah,
death of that
it's
CEO.
Really it's really crazy. It's crazy times. I think there is a real, like, so that's why I think I support Trump, is just because I think it's time, like beyond like the ideologies, beyond the sort of grand plans for what is going to make what's the best economic route or whatever. Like, I'm sure he's going to wreck the economy and whatever, but it was going to get wrecked anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is the Democrats desperately want to return to a pre-Trump era, whereas MAGA and Trump has just become a political reality in America, and the only way to move forward is to acknowledge this reality, no matter if you're for it or against it. But it proves that what we had before the emergence of the MAGA movement was falling apart and isn't sustainable. There are huge sections of the US population, especially think about the people who voted for Trump. They're like really the silent majority that are sick of the duopoly, and say what you will. I mean, yeah, Trump during his first term was pretty captured by establishment Republicans. But the point is, when he was running his campaign, he was positioning himself as a political outsider, as somebody who would fight those elites on behalf of the people. And the fact that so many people recognize that there was a swamp to drain in the first place is very meaningful in US politics. When even just 5 years ago, very maybe not 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, you wouldn't really see that. I mean, people were back then were captured by Obama's whole hope rhetoric. You know, that's more than 10 years ago. Damn. Yeah, like 10 years ago, people wouldn't really think that
Yeah.
there was a swamp to drain, you know? At least not that many people. I'm sure there's a lot of more politically involved people who think that, but that doesn't really mean anything if it's not going down to the lower
I think,
levels of the
and
masses, you know?
it almost feel, I mean, it feels to me like this is not. Like I think with liberals, and you saw this. I mean, you see this a lot in the way liberal elites write about and talk about this popular dissatisfaction. And the thing that the liberals still say, and Paul Krugman, who is sort of like the sort of anointed economic guru of this whole system. In terms of the media, in terms of advising
Yeah,
and
three
stuff,
textbooks written
you
by
know,
him.
absolutely orthodox economist or whatever, neoliberal economist is sort of like neoliberalism with a little bit of like soft elements of,
Yeah.
you know, state welfare and things like this. I mean, the formulation that has convinced a lot of America for a lot of the world for like decades, right, is like we're gonna have the upside of harsh, brutal free market capitalism, but with like a cushion, you know, to make it humane. The way
Yeah.
they talk about it, and Krugman in his going in his final column, which I read today, which pissed me the fuck off just reading it, is this idea that this is a mind virus, guys. You know, like, all right, I think we got our mic situation sorted out. All right.
Yeah.
So I think I was saying, like, you know, the thing that Krugman said in his essay, and a lot of liberals still believe, is that this is an issue of like there being a mind virus. That if you look at like if you look at the objective metrics of the performance of like neoliberalism and, you know, the whole political order, right? Like, fine, there's really nothing wrong. Yes, we've got some problems, but we've always had problems, and what we need to do is like get over our political differences and address it. They're really dismissive of there being real problems, and I think part of it is because they simply don't believe that there's any problems unless it shows up in the econometrics. And that even that is starting to fall apart because they're cherry picking like what they want to look at, and it's pretty clear, honestly, I think in the US at least, that the stats are heavily manipulated. And so it seems to me actually that it's not that we have an ideological problem in the West. I think the system is actually starting to it's diseased, and the disease is start it's like a bottom up disease. There's all sorts of both material and ideological problems that are arising big time, and the system is starting to like truly fail. And when it fails, I think we don't like it's not that there's a competing system that's been designed and it's going to replace the thing. Like, we're just looking at the wholesale failure of this thing. And so a lot of people seem to be resistant to the idea of change because there's nothing waiting in the wings to save us or to replace it and make everything work great again, like make America great again. But I don't know, man. I'm of the opinion that like just clinging to that is pointless. You know what I mean? Like,
it's
going to fail. It's going to fucking fail.
It's also what the DPP is doing, because, you know, if you're living in Taiwan, and let's say if you're a white-collar professional and you got a decent job, you're pretty much shielded from things like inflation or whatever. It doesn't affect you as much. But, I mean, when I did my service for 1 year, it was in rural Taiwan, and everyone there, well, not everyone, but a lot of people there were increasingly upset with the incumbent party. They're upset about the economy. They're upset about just their futures in general. But the DPP just kind of gaslights people, saying, you guys are just being brainwashed by the KMT and the CPC. Look at the numbers. Our GDP per capita is still rising. We're doing great. Our GDP per capita is still higher than that of the mainland. But it's like, yeah, your GDP per capita is rising, but real wages have been stagnant. So what does that mean? That means wealth inequality is increasing.
Increasing.
And if you're not one of the rich people, then, I mean, let's put it this way. Not everybody can be rich, but if more and more people are having difficulty making ends meet, your society is going to fall apart. And being rich isn't going to save you from what's like, from the systemic failures that are going to happen, unless you, I guess, you have a plan to leave and go somewhere else. But where are these people going to go? Like the rich people, they're going to go to places like, you know, the U.S., Australia, Canada, Japan. Yeah, they're facing similar problems too.
Problems. It's the same. Yeah. It's part of the same system, man. You know,
yeah, exactly.
I actually think that the further away you get from the U.S., the worse it gets, actually. The last bastion is going to be here in the United States. We're already seeing Europe just sort of being abandoned, and
right.
You know, Canada, Australia. I mean, we don't have any respect for those motherfuckers at all, nor should we. Japan,
yeah.
Taiwan, South Korea are all going through crisis. Japan has become just a fucking ATM for us. I mean,
yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah, definitely. So, no, Japan's ever since the 90s, I feel like Japan's just kind of entered this sort of zombie state. They're just kind of, you know,
yeah,
moving along, but they're not really.
They're lost.
They are lost.
Completely lost.
Yeah. But I think the saving grace for Taiwan is as the system keeps on failing and as the mainland gets like increasingly better in terms of standards of living. And whatever. I mean, the system here is basically supported by the belief, by the masses that, you know, America's position in the global hegemony will continue. It's a given, and that it's the best and most stable system out there. But when reality challenges this belief, people are going to start shifting their opinions. And I mean, at least there is the option, should the people choose to take it, for reunification with the mainland, which will, I guess, fix a lot of these economic woes. But in the case of South Korea, they don't
really have much of a choice. I mean, what are they going to do? Reunite with North Korea? That seems so unlikely, honestly.
I mean, even if they do, North Korea's population is what, like 25 million. South Korea's like 50 million. And South Korea is a much bigger economy. North Korea, you know, for a variety of reasons, is struggling in a lot of ways economically. Whereas the opposite is true on the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. I mean, for a while, I guess Taiwan was disproportionately richer than the mainland, but that was kind of a historical anomaly.
Let's move to Taiwan in a sec, because I'm not from Taiwan per se, but you know, I have strong ties there because my family's from Taiwan.
Yeah,
but Japan, what are they going to do? Because I feel like they really don't have any option here. You know, they're just going to have to continue. They have no other option than to just sort of ride it all the way to the end with the United States. And they are so disrespected in the West. Like just the way that the currency fall has led to like this swarm of shitty Western tourists just ruining, you know, just like going into Japan and just shitting all over it and making their stupid videos and
Johnny Somali
and all that shit. Like, Is it? Do you? I don't see any way out for them other than, you know, they just sort of go. They just sort of go like into some sort of like crazy, you know, one of their, like, what's going to happen to them?
I mean, I'm not trying to say this to be hyperbolic, but I think nothing short of a full-on revolution will fix Japan, because the way that the system is set up at this, like, since World War II is, okay, we're giving up our imperial ambitions, and we're going to become a junior partner of America because we just got nuked by them. I mean, what other options do you have? I mean, why does Japan keep on denying the war crimes it committed? It's not just in order to save face. It's to save their system, because the way that Japan's worked ever since World War II was basically the existing system was just absorbed into U.S. empire. So if they denounce their past...
You mean sort of like... And South Korea was similar, right? Sort of this sort of top-down industrial economy and that kind of thing? Are you saying like there wasn't a fundamental change in their industrial system and social system?
Well, I guess in South Korea, the people who were... I mean, existing class relations were kind of kept, but I think there were some big changes, because when Korea was unified, agriculture was in the south and industry was in the north, which makes sense because the north is more mountainous. It has really shitty land in the south. But I guess there's similar comparisons everywhere. It's kind of like in Taiwan, for example, when the Japanese came in, how did they govern? I mean, a huge part of it was by winning over the landed aristocracy and governing through them and using their local connections and influence. And the interesting thing about Taiwan is when the KMT came, they were like, okay, yeah, we were screwed on the mainland because we couldn't carry out land reform because the landed aristocracy had us by the balls. But over here in Taiwan, we don't really need your support. And the people here need land reform. And we need land reform to help support continued industrialization. So we're going to, we don't care that your local landed aristocracy, you're not going into the high positions of power in our new government. And it worked for a while, but
you're talking about like sort of late 1940s Taiwan, 1950s or
40s and 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that really planted a landmine. And we're feeling the effects today because the people in the opposition party, the DPP, a lot of them came from those families. And a lot of people try to boil it down to, people support one party if their families came with the KMT, and then they support the other party if their families were, local Taiwanese. But it goes much further than that, because I want to go back to my service. It was in Nantou, like central Taiwan and rural Taiwan. Went to my friend's house over there. He was the IT guy. Oh, now he works at TSMC, but went to his house. His family's been in Nantou for like many generations. His dad's like this factory worker, doesn't even speak standard Mandarin so properly, so that's how like rural he is. And he's one of the biggest critics against the DPP I've ever met. And he's like, this whole divide and conquer strategy, it's like it shouldn't make sense, but there's just so many people who are easily manipulated. It's like people try to boil down problems to a mainlanders coming to Taiwan and screwing everybody over. But it's like, that's not really how things happened. It's a lot more complicated than that. So,
yeah. And is that what you're saying? I mean, because isn't that seems like a line borrowed from Hong Kong, but like in Taiwan, there isn't much. Is there a big flow of people coming in from the mainland?
Oh, no. When he talks about the mainland, he's talking about like the 1945 to 49.
Oh, I see.
Days.
Oh, okay. So they're still talking about old politics.
Yeah, the difference between here and Hong Kong is, I mean, Hong Kong is like connected by bridges to the mainland, and it was returned to China in 1997. Even before the return, I mean, up until the, I think, 70s, Hong Kong's population growth was mostly due to migrations from the mainland. It was only until after the 70s or 80s that it was births that were like that overtook it as the leading factor. Taiwan, I mean, ever since the final wave of migrations from the mainland in the, 1940s and 50s, there hasn't been there have not been significant waves of migration from the mainland. Now, in Taiwan's history, ever since the Qing Dynasty, there have been many waves, but that's kind of stopped. And now the population growth is just kind of, through birth over here. And that's kind of declining in recent years, just like it is almost everywhere else.
Yeah.
I do want to bring up this demographic stuff, because I think what's interesting is there is an age gap between the two of us. And
how old are you?
I am 31.
Okay, I'm 46, so 15 years, yeah.
15 years, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, and I guess your parents had you kind of late, right?
Yeah, I was born 78. My parents were probably, I want to say like 35 when they had me. I was a pretty late child, yeah.
Yeah, so was I. So, like, your parents are in their 80s now.
Correct.
So, 80s. Does that mean your parents were born on the mainland?
No, they were born in Shanghai.
Yeah, they were born in Shanghai, and then they arrived to Taiwan.
They were born in the mainland. Correct.
Yeah. So, like, that's a very interesting dynamic because, you know, most people my generation in Taiwan don't have this connection anymore. It's like, my mom's generation, yeah, she had classmates who had parents that were born on the mainland, but yeah. So then, no wonder your understanding of Taiwan is a little bit different from other, I guess, diasporic. Chinese Americans with some family ties to Taiwan, because a lot of them just get their understanding through organizations like FATPA. But I mean, you listening to your parents growing up and visiting Taiwan, you saw like a side of Taiwan that a lot of people just aren't really aware of today. Because I mean, people like your parents who arrived to Taiwan, like within a generation or two, they've mostly assimilated into the rest of Taiwan and aren't like that different, you know. Well, the assimilation went both ways. Like, local Taiwanese became kind of like mainlandized, and mainlanders who arrived here became like Taiwanified. So
yeah. Also, there's that, and also I think my grandfathers were both, I believe, communist sympathizers.
The way you've described it to me makes it seem like, even if they weren't supporters of the CPC, they could have even been against it, but at the end of the day, they just wanted to see the end of the century of humiliation. They wanted to see the restoration of, you know, China's dignity, the dignity of the Chinese people. They just wanted China to do well, man.
Yeah, correct. I think that, I've always thought that underlying all these, you know, this communist thing versus the nationalist and, you know, whatever, like, and people sort of rail against me. Some people rail against me when I said, others people completely agree. I think that nationalism was a much, much bigger force than we in the West like to discuss, because nationalism has a unifying effect.
Yes.
Whereas these ideological battles one of the things about liberal foreign policy and this focus on human rights is inherently divisive. It's inherently about locating some minority group or some group that's being oppressed by another dominant group. And it's typically, we find the polarity where it's like, well, of course, our adversary, Russia, is the one that's always doing the oppressing. The Russians can never oppress. We would never talk about Russian ethnic minorities living in Ukraine getting slaughtered. We never talk about that.
Right. No, it's actually hegemonic, because the whole foundation of that sort of ideology is the notion of universal values. But how can there be universal values in this world when there are so many different civilizations with, you know, thousands of years of history? They make sense of society in many different ways. They have different cultural values. You can't just say, okay, there's going to be universal values, and it's either this or you are the bad guys. And I think a lot of the schizophrenia, the political schizophrenia you see in Taiwan, is the attempt at adopting this ideology, which is in and of itself at odds with the local culture here, which is rooted in Chinese civilizational culture, whether you want to admit it or not. Yeah, Taiwan's only been like fully integrated into China for 400 years, but the vast majority of this island, starting from like 400 years ago, were people from the mainland who brought the civilizational culture from there over here. You can't get rid of this culture and say you're defending like Taiwan's unique identity without committing cultural autogenocide.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, There's a real confusion, I think, in the way people talk about Chinese, where it's like, and it's, I think it's for the benefit of anyone who wants to advance a particular argument against, you know, to support the division of, I'd call the Sinosphere, right? Like,
right.
Because it's not necessarily it's not that well defined. Like, that's the thing. These are like fuzzy concepts. Like, Chinese to me is a very fuzzy concept when it comes to who's in and out. Like, there is Chinese culture, of course, there's Chinese history.
Yeah.
In terms of the in and out, it's not a sharp boundary. But you can
draw it's like Singaporean boundaries. Chinese, they're Chinese, but they're not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas like in Chinese, there is a difference. Like, for example, when you say like 中国人, that means like a Chinese person from China, whereas 华人 means like a person of Chinese origins, but they're not necessarily like in China. So like Lee Kuan Yew, he's a 华人, but he's not a 中国人. But in English, it just becomes, it's lost in translation, and both terms just mean Chinese. And like, I guess when you try to say like some Singaporean is Chinese, some Westerners will be like, oh, you're just being chauvinistic, and you're trying to say everybody's a part of you. And it's like, not really. We're acknowledging a civilizational connection, but we're not really trying to claim that they're a part of this country. You know what I mean?
I think the Russians have a very similar view of this. Like Putin has talked about this, saying that there's a fundamental difference in perception, where in the West we think of this as a issue of national sovereignty, respect of Ukrainian culture. And from the or at least from Putin's perspective, and this came out of his own mouth, he was like, you should think of this as a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
We consider this part of this, you know, the same family, so to speak. And
right.
Like when you bring up the Singaporeans, I remember, like, this is an example, like when Tom Cotton was grilling the CEO of TikTok America.
Oh yeah.
And he kept trying to say, you're Chinese, right? He's like, sir, I'm Singaporean, but you're Chinese. And the funny thing was, I was like, yeah, he is Chinese.
Oh yeah, I was thinking that too, but it's like,
he is Chinese, but in a sense. But the thing is, he's, because it's fuzzy, you can, given the context, that guy, I forgot his name, but like the TikTok guy, can easily switch registers of what Chinese means and say, no, it's a nationality, I'm not Chinese, don't call me Chinese. Which probably might go against the way he thinks about, his cultural identity.
I guarantee you, within Singapore, though, he probably identifies as Chinese. Like Chinese,
exactly. But in Congress, he's Singaporean.
Yeah, because in Singapore, there is a pretty sharp divide between like the Malays, the Indians, the Chinese. It's pretty interesting though, because once I was scrolling on I think Instagram or something, and I saw an argument between a taxi driver and a passenger, and the passenger was Indian and the taxi driver was Chinese, but because of like the cultural contact through I guess many decades and generations, the Chinese taxi driver sounded kind of Indian, and the Indian the Indian auntie like arguing with this with the Chinese dude sounded kind of Chinese, like the way she spoke.
You know, sometimes I like to have the, you know, say, I'll see a conversation and I'll try to, in my head, I'll see if I could imagine how it would continue. And so in the TikTok grilling, you know, if I was Cotton, I'd be like, but you speak Chinese, right? Like Chinese is, you primarily speak Chinese if you're not speaking English. And if I was the CEO guy, I'd be like, but what are you speaking? You're speaking English. Yep. So does that make you English, right? And and to that, I would say, lately, I've been wondering if actually Americans, especially like sort of Trumpist Americans, but also I think more and more liberals, are starting to feel the loss of national identity. And by national, I don't mean just American identity. It's expanding beyond simply American borders. And that's why I think, what do you think? I think that's why
there's been national nihilism.
There is a national nihilism. I think that's why there's been this sort of like sudden sort of sophomoric reassertion of Western We like to, the word Western has never been used more,
right?
In from what I, in my belief, than
and
it has
coming
now.
From a place of desperation, right? From your perspective, like you have people that are like, oh, we need to be pan-Western and we need to defend the white race. But it's like, I think when people get fixated on race, whether it's be like, oh, it's white nationalism or pan-Asianism or whatever, it's because their actual connection to a national culture has already been severed, and race is the most observable trait that has some tangential relationship with, you know, culture and national origin. So they cling on to that. I mean,
I think that you're right that there are strands of this that are essentially a cover up for white race identity, and Americans are in particular are race obsessed. You're right. So
right.
A lot of them use it as a euphemism for white or European stock. You know,
oh, definitely.
But
you see, like Drew Pavlou, you know that fat fuck Drew Pavlou.
Yeah,
it's really funny because a lot of his critics, like people who are like up in his replies, just always clowning him. They're either like anti-imperialists, or they're like these Australian white nationalists telling him to go back to Greece.
Yeah. Exactly. But so let me posit this though, that in a way this is a very natural thing that, I've always felt that. I've long felt this is why, like, I'm not that confused in my opinion, like relative to a lot of people. I feel like a lot of things that are happening make sense to me. I don't feel like when I see what's going on, I'm not like, what's going on? I kind of understand. Like, I kind of understand why there is this weird sudden reassertion of Western identity and Western civilization. And maybe this concept actually that the capital, the center of Western identity may move around. And in fact, it probably has moved over to the United States from Europe.
It has, yeah.
But we still one people. We're still one people. And the American Empire is really, you know, it's a single nation in a way. Like they're trying to nationalize the empire into a single identity.
Ooh.
And I understand that drive. Is what I'm saying.
Right.
I don't know if it's right or wrong. I don't know if it could lead to some disaster, but I get it. I think I get it.
I've actually come up with, I thought about this before, and you know, some people criticize China's one country, two system policy when it comes to Hong Kong. And I told my friends in Taiwan who are critical of it, it's like, well, you know, it's actually demonstrates a degree of flexibility if you're willing to have two systems within one country. I was like, what is America pushing for? I said, 万国一制. So it's like tens of thousands of countries under one system. Instead of like one country, two systems within one country, you have like a bunch of countries that they want under one system. And 一制, I guess, if you write it with different characters, one is like they're all like uniform, and the other means like one system. It's yeah. I think that's basically what you're saying, and I think the driving force of that is like modern day liberalism and the revival of conservatism that we're seeing recently is a desperate struggle against that. One that I don't think will work, but it's a natural reaction to what we're seeing nonetheless. It's kind of like how during the Obama years, especially after Occupy, the Democrats really started putting like wokeness into overdrive. And for a while, it became like very dominant, and then there was pushback, and now we're seeing the pushback like get to reach heights that it hasn't in, I guess, around a decade.
Yeah. I think also if the thing I do respect about Trump's worldview is that he reasserts this concept that that there is a American national identity.
Yeah.
Which is separate from even Canada and Europe and Australia. Like, we are Americans, and that's a unique
with a
thing.
Unique history, yeah, good or bad.
Like, right. And so maybe there's a distinction, I think, and to an extent.
I think what you're saying is there is a distinct American national identity, but it's never really been completely defined. I guess
correct.
You had the
ongoing
American
project.
Revolution, the Civil War, and those were different steps in trying to figure this stuff out. But then once you've gotten to like modern day, like universalism, like on this Western hegemony, the lines are getting blurred again, and now there's this reconciliation that needs to take place for people to understand where they fit in under this entire thing and what their national identity is as Americans.
I think that is the sort of foundation of Trump's reaction. Right. So I think the emergence of the emergence of these right-wing populist movements does have like a material grounding, right? Like we couldn't buy it off.
Like some leftists will try to say, well, all of that's fake and invalid because America is just stolen land and everybody's a settler. Well, correct, let's just accept this. Let's just accept this as fact for the sake of argument. It happened.
Exactly. Like, whether it's invalid or not, based on reality. It's reality. That's what happened. This is the situation we find ourselves in. And
how do you make sense of it? Right. You're not going to wish it out of existence. You need to find a path forward.
Yeah. I mean, even if we accept that that's true, what are we supposed to do? I mean, unless these leftists are willing to leave America, then I don't really know what they're. I mean, you can say stolen land this, stolen land that in your bio, but it doesn't mean a goddamn thing to anyone.
Honestly, if I were Native American and I saw that, I'd be pretty insulted. It's like, okay, you're self-flagellating, but what are you doing about it? Are you giving any of the land back? You're screaming land back, but like, what are you doing? What's really disingenuous is the people who do that, they always position themselves as one of the good ones, one of the allies, and then they go attack like other white people who always happen to be like of a lower socioeconomic status. And it's really just classism, but then they disguise it as like, you know, like social justice, which is very disgusting to me.
It could be. I think there's a psychological personality aspect to it too. There's something very subjective about that, might be more of a cycle. To me, I think there's a psychological aspect to it too.
And there are a lot of like young
non-material. Yeah. Basically. Yeah.
A lot of it's like these white kids who don't have the best relations with their parents. And I think I think when they say they are against the white man, it's just a stand-in for their father figures.
Could be a stand-in for some trauma, could be a stand-in for something.
And I'm not invalidating or denying their trauma or whatever. I feel like it's really real, especially if you're living in these awkward times. I think part of why you are more grounded is because you grew up during an era. You were born in what, 78?
Yeah.
You were born in a time when I guess people were, I mean, it wasn't a perfect time, but these things weren't, to me at least, I mean, I never lived in the 1980s. They weren't at the forefront of like existential, like the way people made sense of themselves, and like existential crises didn't like have as huge of an impact as they do today, because at least back then, the whole society and system at least on the surface seemed to be working much better than it is today, right?
It worked much better. And okay, so I think for me, when I don't go to China very often. I haven't been there in 5 years. I'm hoping to go again soon. But what I see from the sort of like online perspective of it, and you see this nation building itself up, it's advancing. People's lives are getting better, not just because they're getting wealthier, but because the society is becoming more high trust and focused. And so I know there are problems. But I am saying like there is an idealized version of China that is partially true. It's completely incomplete, but there is something going on in China where you could see the development of this incredible space program with huge ambitions. You see the development of high tech industry with just like boundless creativity about what that could enable in the future. You see, I would actually say you would see a growing belief in middle class prosperity rather than I'm going to become this rich as fuck and I'm going to become a little duke. Like people are kind of like, no, I just want like a nice life. Mm-hmm. And I want, you know, but I want to have meaningful work and I want to, you know, do this. And there's all this, there's just so much energy and full spectrum, like opportunities, and you know, whatever. Okay, that's idealized. I know.
I think people on the mainland, on the Chinese mainland, in China, but especially on the Chinese mainland, are looking more like physically and mentally healthy. Because, yeah. I mean, the first time I traveled to the mainland was in 2005 and then again in 2007. And then I hadn't, and then for like over 10 years, I didn't go back until, I believe, 2018.
Yeah.
And the difference was stark because, I mean, the first time I visited Beijing in 2005, I mean, I thought I had a good time. I liked it. But I thought it was kind of lagging behind still. Because keep in mind, this was before the 2008 Olympics. I thought of it as like, it was still like, developing. But now I go to Beijing and it's like, well, it's, well, actually it's not the nicest city for like as far as like standard of living goes. I personally, I'd rather live in a place like Chengdu, but it is a nice city. It is a modern city is what I'm saying.
And there's a certain feeling or energy that's very hard to quantify.
Right.
But it reminds me, I'm telling you, dude, it really reminds me of life in the mid to late 80s.
Oh, really?
In America. It really does. And sort of like, especially sort of like pre, I do think things changed in the 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But like,
I feel like it's after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it became like, okay, it became an existential crisis in and of itself. It's like, okay, well, what do we stand for now when for the majority of the century, we were positioning ourselves as the as opposers of communism?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's something about the late 80s and the way that I think China's what I perceive in China really reminds me of the U.S. in the 80s, where everything was just, you know, I think there was a real sense of like futurism, mm-hmm. space program, computers, middle class wealth, really, you know, really, really going up, and a modernism. And a feeling like, dude, this is the place. This is where it's happening right now. And it wasn't greed. That's the thing. It's like right now we just want to shit on America and we want to say that, you know, it started as a settler colonial this and a slavery that. And yes, it's everyone understands. But if you were to really look at, in a relative sense, where we are now versus where we are in the 80s when I was growing up.
I think like, what you're saying is in the 80s, the average person in America who was doing well for himself did not have the mindset of like, oh, we want to like screw other people over or correct. We want to get rich for the sake of getting rich. It's like we just want to maintain a certain level of a living standard and we want our children to have the same, if not better.
And and it felt like everything was moving in like
that direction.
Yeah, we didn't think that we like we weren't like when it came to the Soviet Union, it was weird. Like people don't really quite recall like the level of like sort of respect that we had for the Soviets and the Russians, and we really respected Russian culture. We really respected Russian arts.
Behind the ideological contention was that level of respect. It was because they were a formidable enemy. And you have to respect that unless you're coping.
Yes, exactly. And there it was not, we didn't hate Russians. We didn't hate the Soviet Union. We had a vehement sort of feeling of like competition and a belief that we are the better, the better competitor. But on the other hand, we were like, you know, when it comes to sports, when it comes to literature, when it comes to science and space and military and all this stuff, like we had a huge amount of respect for them. And in the 90s, it just became, you know, when the Soviet Union fell, I think it just became like the bottle and the champagne popped. And we just fucking raped Russia, dude. The West.
Yeah.
And it just became... we really like 90s, you could definitely start seeing that there was a good amount of degeneracy. The culture became more degenerate in the 90s. Mm-hmm. People became more degenerate and selfish and race obsessed.
Right.
And I think sexuality became very vulgar. Mm-hmm. And genuine emotions gave way to irony.
Right.
And being genuine became sort of a thing that old fogies did, and you know, and I feel like the trajectory has just there's been really no reversal. It's just been right.
In the 90s was also a time when deindustrialization in America was really ramping up. I mean, you look at, for example, I think a cultural phenomenon, Eminem back then was a huge reflection of that. I think a lot of people, a lot of older parents did not like him because he was a reflection of everything that you were just saying. And he's from Detroit. What was Detroit? What did Detroit used to be known for? Like, you know, auto manufacturing, but because of
deindustrialization. At one point, the wealthiest city in America.
Yeah, but because of deindustrialization, someone like him, you know, like, I guess if you were born a generation before, he could drop out of school and go work at GM and be able to support a family and have a decent sized house, you know, afford maybe vacation once a year or something like that. But then with deindustrialization and just working really shitty jobs at like local diners, it's it kind of shaped who he is. Plus, you know, all that, like, for lack of a better term, like poor white trash, like trauma, family shit. It's a side of America that people didn't want to face or acknowledge was there, you know?
Yeah, I think there it came from a certain worship of wealth.
Right.
That it's sad because like I just think like and I hope this doesn't happen to Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
That we
it did
that
you, like cent- a century ago.
A century, yeah. No, but I'm saying like what they have now,
right,
that it doesn't result in I think there was a like here's the thing, I think there's always a generational handover problem.
Oh, definitely.
You know, that we don't really recognize so much in our models of how political economy sort of evolves, like
because it kind of creeps up on you. It's not just like it's not like, you know, your parents passing down their house to you. It's a much longer and protracted process, and then before you know what it happens, it's like now you're all of a sudden you are looking at the staff of the White House and they're all younger than you. Well, not all, but a lot of them are.
Yeah
it just kind of creeped up on you, right?
It just kind of creeped up on you. But there's also this belief, if you start looking at the culture of the late 80s, you start seeing this a lot, that a lot of the supposed what I would call the sort of like liberal anti-establishment feeling, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're obviously the establishment now, but like that sense of anti-establishment, it was not ideological. It was not grounded in anything. It was a frustration that their older generation was not handing over the reins of power, number mm-hmm. one. And then number two, there was this sort of conservatism to that older generation where the younger people were like, why don't you just have a, why don't, like, why aren't we going out and like taking this to fucking level 11, like why are you holding back, you know? Mm-hmm. There was an anger at the reluctance and conservatism of the older generation that just felt stifling and oppressive to this younger generation that wanted to come up. And then we understood how, as we grew up, how powerful, how wealthy we are as a nation, especially the elites. And the elites were like, just hand it over, give it to me now. Like, why are we doing this? Like, why are you not giving me everything now and letting me run this shit now? Right. Which is like a Ferris Bueller type anti-establishment mm-hmm. thing, you know, just rebel against the parents and whatever. And to the extent that I think eventually power gets handed over. And I don't think it's just about I don't think it's just about the kids and the older people, but it's like a whole cohort generational shift.
Right, right.
And by the 90s, man, you know, you started seeing everything starting to really focus on youth culture. Everything was geared towards selling to youth.
Mm-hmm.
And and there was also this.
I'm having flashbacks to 90s commercials because, I mean, I wasn't here for the 80s, but I have pretty vivid memories of the 90s and just like the consumerism.
Yeah, how MTV became a sort of like a very powerful corporatized force for culture.
Yeah,
and but a lot of it, I think, was I think just this realization that like the peak of the United States, there was an inherent conservatism to it and an inherent modesty I would say in the culture that really frustrated young people and they wanted it out. And so this is such an old man opinion, but when I see there being a generational attack on the inherent like sort of modesty and conservatism of the older generation without any appreciation for what that meant, I think you're starting to see a sort of degeneration starting to take place. And now in 2024, I'm like, without doubt, that's what happened, because we're completely fucking degenerate at this point.
You know, what's really interesting is I think the development in Taiwan lags about, like, when it comes to this cultural stuff, it's like a decade behind the US. Like the optimism that you're describing of the 1980s in America, I saw that in the 1990s in Taiwan, because I mean, people were still riding off of the wave of the successes of the, you know, the 10 economic projects and the great economic miracle that happened in the 1980s. And people thought that that would just last another 10 years.
Would you agree that maybe the 90s might have been like a cultural sort of like high point for Taiwan as well, in terms of like film and music and stuff like that, right? I feel like 90s Taiwan was like culturally quite a big force in Asia.
I think it was a big force because also martial law had ended and people had levels of creative freedom of expression that they did not have before. And there was this overall sense of optimism, because whereas in America, people were like, oh, our formidable like opponent is gone now, and we kind of just fucked them over, and now they're kind of a shithole. In Taiwan, I think even in the early 90s, a lot of people thought, well, the Soviet Union fell, the Eastern Bloc fell, maybe the mainland, this Communist Party of China would go along too, and we're going to see Chinese reunification under liberal democracy. There was that sense of optimism, but then that's not how things panned out. However, the mainland started getting rich. So then it was like you had people in Taiwan going, well, maybe a lot of the things that we were told about the mainland, the communists were not exactly true, or maybe they were true, but it's a thing of the past and we can work together for a better future. And then 2000 comes along, and then you had the first DPP administration kind of grooming the next generation of Taiwanese youth to just not view themselves as Chinese at all, to kind of just break this trajectory while it was still in its infancy. This 90s, I just remember so much optimism in Taiwan as a kid. And I know,
and greatness, man. I got to say, like, some of the films coming out of Taiwan in the 90s, like some of the best movies ever made, in my opinion.
And music industry too. Taiwan was the capital of like Mandopop.
Mandopop, yeah. 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 Like a lot of superstars in China, in the Sinosphere, so many came from Taiwan. Like this little island, like so many huge singers and actors and stuff and film directors.
Yeah. People like Jackie Chan got big in Taiwan before they got big on the mainland. Well, that's because they were still in the process of opening up. But I mean,
now,
like,
in the West, at least we quite appreciate the greatness of like Ang Lee and Edward Yang, and they weren't the only ones. But like Taiwanese cinema was like probably some of the best films, sort of modern films, that reached like global audiences, right? And you watch them and they're legit fucking masterpieces.
You know what I think is fucked up about the DPP today is they're absent policy successes. They're just basically paying off Western mainstream media to give Taiwan positive news coverage. And the goal of that is to make Taiwanese youth feel good about being Taiwanese because Westerners are saying good things about us. But that's basically, that's so artificial. I think
it is.
When I think about the 90s and all the things that you mentioned, that was when it felt good to be Taiwanese. And back then, like, Taiwan separatism wasn't even that mainstream. It was more like, we're proud of Taiwan. We're proud of being Taiwanese, but we're Chinese as well. And it's like, we want this level of success to be a model for our compatriots on the mainland. But now the tides have turned and people are still trying to come to terms with that reality. And I'm just like, man, I think friendly competition between the two sides of the strait is a good thing, but what's
that's
going
what
on
made
now,
Taiwan. That's what made Taiwan. That's what made Taiwan such a special place.
It is. And you know, people think back Cold War, blah blah blah. Yeah, there were hostilities, but at the end of the day, I think it was framed by the leaders of the two sides as, okay, this is a competition between Chinese people. Nowadays, it's like they're trying to deny that history and just be like, no, we're Taiwanese, we're not Chinese. And you know what's really sad is the DPP recently, they're doing these educational reforms to put less emphasis on literary or like classical Chinese. And the result of that is, I mean, yeah, spoken vernacular Chinese isn't the same as literary Chinese, but having a good grasp of literary Chinese is very helpful for, you know, writing, like for good writing, because there's so many references to that in written Chinese, even to this day. And the goal is, well, their excuse is we don't want our children to be wasting time on these things that are impractical. But the real reason is they want to sever the cultural ties with the Chinese mainland. While at the same time, they're trying to push for education in local languages like Hokkien, what people erroneously call Taiwanese, or Hakka. But the thing is, Hokkien and Hakka are also Chinese languages, and you get to a high enough level, what do you need to study? You still need to study this classical Chinese. So it's it's this cultural schizophrenia. People are trying to reckon with all of these changes that you've been mentioning, but they're going about it in a very self-destructive way that doesn't address the root causes. And it's just, I think they're just going deeper and deeper into this rabbit hole of crazy.
I think this is why, if, when you don't have the sort of this sort of almost national beacon of like, of advancement, it wasn't just advancement. This sounds snobby, but it is a sense of sophistication.
It was.
You are building something sophisticated, intellectual, but also materially unbelievable, like the things that your society is starting to produce. And
you know what?
It's mesmerizing, and it's sad when it's gone, but I think that it's in China now.
It is. I think, and the thing is, back then in Taiwan, there wasn't this sort of national nihilism. I mean, yeah, then starting in the 80s, wasn't. You had some Taiwan separatists. When was the first time you visited Taiwan as a kid?
I don't even remember when. I was probably like 1979.
1979?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then.
And you visited in the 80s?
I visited numerous times in the 80s, 90s. Yeah.
So you saw a lot of these changes that I'm describing, because like prior to the 90s, it's not firsthand information for me, obviously. But you saw in the... Man, so you remember the Jiang Jingguo era.
I do. Yeah. Yeah, very well.
What was that like visiting Taiwan back then? Because
I would say actually Taiwan was right. Like when I go to Taiwan, actually, you know what? This might be a good crossover point to doing a bonus side, because I think this is a really interesting conversation. To get access to like bonus pods and Discord and stuff, go to these bonus pods will have a whole other episode there. Go to patreon.com/planningmag if you want to support. And all right, we'll see you next time.